Good morning. I grew up in a small city. It's called Jennings, Missouri. And it's actually the same house that my father grew up in. And so we are about half the size of Manassas, and we are bordered by, on one side, the city, and we are in the north side of the city. Takes about 12 minutes or so from where I lived to get down to the arch and all the, you know, the ball field, you know, the baseball field and the Cardinals and all the other things in the downtown area. So we're very, very close to the city. And on the other side of where we lived, it was Ferguson. Yes, that Ferguson. And what I saw as a kid when I was growing up, we lived on a kind of a main street, a main drag. And when a person would be pulled over, 99% of the time, it was an all-white police force, of course, and this was in the early 60s, it was 99% of the time, it was an African-American that they were pulling over. And I know it was 99% of the time because 1% of the time, there was a group of teenagers on their way to a Yes concert that got pulled over, and they had to pour out all their beer, but that's a whole nother story. I don't know, really, I don't know anything about that. But another event that was happening, and it came north as opposed to south. St. Louis is a very divided city. You've got the south, and you've got the north St. Louis. What was happening during my time as a kid was African Americans would buy a house in a neighborhood, and what would happen was, of course, there would be, you know, the usual stars and bars and the burning and the rocks and everything, but they would persevere, and they would hold their ground because they wanted a better place to live. So what happened next was the realtors, and I remember when it got to our neighborhood and this happened, the realtors would just be banging on the door. Everything you own is going to be worthless if you don't sell today. If you don't sell today, this house is going to be worthless. Now, my parents hung through there because this was the house that my father grew up in, and they were holding their ground. They didn't care. They weren't going anywhere. I had an aunt that moved to St. Charles County to get away from the N-word. And even to this day, St. Louis City, while it's very blue, St. Charles County is a very pocket of red. So from those days when everybody left. And that was called white flight. So I was observing that. Now, as a white male, obviously, I never felt that. I could only see what it was. And I had no idea what it must be like to be pulled over just because of the color of my skin. I had no idea to not be able to get a job because of the color of my skin. I had no idea what it was like to go to a really bad school because of the color of my skin. And now it's spread out more, even because of not just the color but of your skin, but what your religion is, and what language you speak, and whether people think profile on you. So I don't know if we've gotten any better, but that's also another service. So one of the things that happened in 2011 was the police force of Jennings, the whole police force, was disbanded, except for one lieutenant. And the reason they were disbanded was because of prejudice, profiling, embezzlement, bribery, you name it, they were doing it. And a lot of this had started much before when I was a kid. And it was like, and I say it's like in the DNA. And it's a really hard cycle to break. So what they did is they decided to cleanse everything and start again. Now, one of the officers from that was relieved and from the disbanded police force joined the Ferguson police force. And he turned out to be the officer that shot Michael Brown. So you kind of wonder about what did he take with him? What did he learn? And, you know, this is where the Black Lives Matter comes from. It comes out of a feeling, and people say, well, all lives matter. Well, yes, that's true. But that's sort of like Reaganomics and trickle down where, you know, if everybody, you know, by the time it gets down to the people that need the justice, the people that are, you know, have the greatest economic poverty and the worst schools and the worst chances and the highest rates of incarceration, that's where you have to start. Because for our society to get better, you don't start at the top and work your way down. You have to make Black Lives Matter. Because once you make Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. And I'm behind that. I saw it. And one of the things that I really, in my heart, agree with. And from the year of 2014 until present, every single UU World has had an article about Black Lives Matter. And I don't know if you noticed in the last Black Lives Matter article, they're donating $5.3 million to Blue. Does anybody know what Blue is? Nope, it's not police officers. Blue are Black Lives Unitarian Universalists. Our denomination is giving $5.3 million towards that cause, towards social, racial justice. Now, the unfortunate side of that, of the Black Lives Matters, is it's put a lot of focus in on the police, because they're the ones out there. They're the ones that have been targeted a lot, you know, pinpointed on what you see on the news and what, you know, and some of it, and a lot of it's very, you know, is a very fair opinion of what's going on. I mean, you can see what happened in Ferguson when you had an officer from Jennings, this extremely racist and prejudiced police force that had to be disbanded, and he goes into Ferguson and shoots a black man over possibly stealing some cigars. But that's not what it's about. It's not about retribution to the police. Now, some have taken it that way. Last year, there were 21 ambushes of police officers that were killed, and they think a lot of them were out of the same feeling of, you know, from the Black Lives Matters, that people were taking this into their own hands to, you know, for retribution against the police. Of course, on the other side, then you see Dylann Roof, who's, so Black Lives Matter is a peaceful movement. They're not talking about retribution. They're not talking about vengeance. They're talking about awareness. They're talking about understanding. They're talking about bringing people together to make all of us better. So it comes down to that if black lives matter, then all lives matter. And I want to read something again from Reverend Nancy McDonald Ladd. She's very prolific in the UU world. She seems to be in there at least once a year. But this is from the spring of 2015. And I'm going to paraphrase and shorten it because it's kind of long. And it's called Black Lives Matter. And it's Universalism in Practice by Nancy McDonald Ladd. I'll get a drink here real quick. Did Michael Brown steal the cigars from the convenience store in Ferguson that day last August? National headlines wrapped themselves around that question as if the answer to it changed anything at all, including the death and the suffering and the loss. I thought then, and I think now, what the hell does it matter in this grand tragedy of national and international pain if the boy stole cigars? If each person is endowed with inherent worth and dignity, then humankind cannot be categorized, and thus whole groups of humankind cannot be dismissed. It is not just one kind of person or one category of persons who are offered every blessing of life and every dignity. It is everyone, whether you deserve it or not, whether you stole the cigars or not, it does not matter. By focusing our national discourse on Michael Brown's perceived culpability or lack thereof, we seem to be asking, as a nation, if he did or did not deserve to die that day. In this nation, we focus not only on whether or not Michael Brown was guilty, but whether or not he was the right kind of young black man. Was he the kind of young black man who deserved to walk free, or was he the kind of young black man that ultimately got what he deserved? You do not have to be good enough to be a good enough young black man to not get shot on the street. You do not have to be the right kind of immigrant to deserve basic health care when you are dying. You do not have to be the right kind of girl to not be raped. You do not have to be good enough to deserve basic human rights. You do not have to earn safety. We are inherently enough. We do not have to prove it. My next reading comes from the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police and Foundation. This was from the Virginia, the 2016 VACP Awards for Valor. On February 27th, 2016, Prince William County police officers, I may not get through this, Jesse Hempen and David McCowan, along with new officer Ashley Gwinden, responded to a report of a domestic disturbance. The victim was able to communicate the assault prior to the phone being abruptly disconnected. Upon arrival, all three officers were quickly ambushed at the doorway by the male resident, who was armed with an assault rifle and a handgun. This suspect used the assault rifle to shoot and critically wound each of the officers in the front yard and retreated into the house. Officers McGowan and Hempen believed the suspect intended to further harm others in the area, include any responding officers. Officer Hempen, while injured, crawled to a concealed position to radio back critical information about the shooting. Though critically wounded, officers McGowan and Hempen calmly and clearly communicated the movement of the suspect, provided perimeter points of vantage, and conveyed each of the officers' positions, observed injuries and associated medical needs. All three officers remained in imminent risk for continued assault by the suspect, but remained vigilant to protect both neighbors in the area and the elementary school-aged son of the involved party who was attempting to flee the house. Their diligence and commitment to containing the suspect ensured the safety of the young boy and prevented any additional officers or citizens from being harmed. The officers were immediately disabled upon arriving at the scene of what turned out to be the murder of a wife by her husband and the murder of their fellow officer, Ashley Gwinden, who was shot along with them. Officers McGowan, Hempen, and Gwinden demonstrated the utmost bravery and courage in continuing to fight for their lives, the lives of the neighboring citizens, the son of the suspect, and the lives of their fellow officers responding to assist them. Because of the information they were able to convey, the suspect was taken into custody without further injury to any persons. They were faced with an unimaginable situation, and their acts of valor allowed resolution to this terrible situation and restored safety to the community. Ann and I, that night, were eating dinner. It was about 6:20. We got a phone call, and it was from Jesse's wife, who was telling us that there was a police officer there, and she and her and their little girl, who's 9 months, Quinn, were going to be rushed to Fairfax Hospital, where Jesse was being flown to, because he was shot. I don't know. We live like 4 blocks from here, and I don't know if people have ever tried to drive from Manassas to Fairfax Hospital, but on a Saturday night, we made it there in 20 minutes. When we got to the emergency room, there was a Fairfax officer, and he took our keys, and he said, just go in. They parked the car. When I got there, there was a young man sitting at a desk, and he had like a blue shirt, so, you know, like Prince William officer, and he looked like he was flowing. And I was like, oh, maybe he's okay. And then I looked. And I looked into the room of the emergency room. And you know, you see these TV shows of the emergency room where everybody's running around and the doctors are ordering this and people are pumping blood and there's blood, you know, and it looks like chaos, but it also is like this chaotic dance where everybody knows what they're supposed to do. And that's where he was. And Dave and Ashley had already been taken up for emergency operations since they were so badly wounded. Not that Jesse wasn't. When he got to the hospital, his hemoglobin was down to 4.5. Now, some of you may not know what that means, but a normal hemoglobin for a young man his age and should be a 15. So he lost about 2/3 of his blood. When they had him in the helicopter, his veins had collapsed, so they had to go through the jugular to put in any kind of IV. And when we were there, they were running around, and they were pumping blood in him, they were pumping plasma in him, and they were feeling a pulse in his, you know, to make sure that the blood was flowing in, into the bottom, of, you know, to his foot. One of the things we do know that if it had hit the artery, he would have died on the scene. And if they had been probably maybe 5 or 10 minutes later, longer, if the gentleman, you know, hadn't given up when he did, there's a chance he would have bled to death at the scene. So it was very, very close. So when the doctor came out and he spoke to us, and he said, look, it's a massive injury, muscle injury. He said, we know a couple of things. One is that, during this time, Jesse's wife is signing all the papers, like agreeing that they can amputate the leg, you know. And so he's telling us that as massive and as terrible as this wound was, that there was a good chance that there would be a pretty good recovery. They would have to do a couple of operations, or at least another operation after that. It obviously didn't hit the artery. It didn't hit the bone. And it seemed to have missed the nerve, which was, I mean, what gets me sometimes is when something terrible, really terrible, happens to someone, and people go, oh, my heavens, how lucky they were. And that's how lucky he was. Because any one of those things could have, you know, I mean, we're talking about a huge wound. And if any of one of those things had happened, it would be a whole different story. So Ann and I went up and we went to this big room with some relief because we knew he wasn't going to die. It sounded like he had a good prognosis for recovery. And we were in this room, probably 150, maybe more, Fairfax and Prince William and other law enforcement, when just this huge wail of agony and pain and grief. And that's when they announced Ashley's passing. And here we are, feeling these mixed feelings about our son is going to be okay. I mean, he's going to have a recovery, and there might be some residual effect, but he's going to live, you know. And then this. And then how can you have both feelings? How can you feel relief and devastation at the same time? Needless to say, it was a rough night. Jesse got, you know, that night when he came out of surgery, it was like 2:30 in the morning. And what he wanted to know was how the other two were doing. How were Dave and Ashley doing? Well, nobody had said much about Ashley, but they were talking kind of about, well, Dave was in really bad shape. He was in critical condition. It looked promising that he was going to be able to make it, even though his elbow was completely destroyed. His leg was destroyed. There was another shot in his abdomen. How's Ashley doing? Well, Dave is doing okay, you know. And finally, he was starting to get a little upset because he wanted to know how his partners did and how they were. So finally, the Chief Hudson at that time and two majors and Jesse's captain, Captain Vago, showed up. And they were all in Saturday night street clothes because a couple of them had rushed out and left their families at restaurants and called for other relatives to pick them up. And so Captain Vago finally told Jesse because Jesse was like getting angry. And Jesse was like, I can handle this. I didn't know if we could or if I could, but he did. So about 3 days later, when Ashley was, they had her funeral service, it was at the Hilton Christian Center over in Woodbridge, which holds about 4,000 people, and the place was absolutely packed. And Ann and I had gotten a ride from the Prince William County police officers, and we were able to go in early, and so when it came time for the service, we were ushered back in, and we were about the fourth or fifth row, just behind Ashley's family, and in front of Jesse's squad. And Dave's father and I were called the Weepy Dads. Ann and Pat, Dave's mother, I don't know, they just seemed to really just be so strong. But Don and I, every time we talked, it was just like here. Well, we were in way up front at this service, and the soprano got up to sing Amazing Grace. And two notes were out. And Anne just lost her breath. It just took her breath away. And at that point, it took my breath away. So the whole place was very quiet, this soprano, but they could hear us, and they could see us because we lost it. We lost it. And we finally made it through the service, and they brought us out, and we were standing behind the hearse. And everybody else was filed out, and they put Ashley's casket in the hearse. And they do this thing that they call end of watch. And sometimes you'll see that I have this on here. And end of watch is when they call off an officer's number. And it's their last time their number's called. And it's called end of watch. And you can't go through that without just an amazing feeling, you know. Ashley Gwinden, end of watch, 2/27/16. So, Jesse got better. Dave went through a lot of surgeries. There was a lot of things that went on. It wasn't until like a few months later, and Ann didn't even really know about this. Actually, she didn't know about some of this until yesterday when I was talking about the service. And I got full of rage, just full of rage. How could my denomination have Black Lives Matter, every single magazine, and forget my son, who from the age of 15 months till he was 18 years old was a Unitarian Universalist and part of this church, and then took those principles with him to become a police officer? How come they forget him? Why and where are the articles about him? Basically about me. I mean, really, it was about me. It was about me and my family. You know, where was that? And it caused a great amount of anguish, anger, rage, and I just didn't know where to go with it. And I remember, if you remember back a while when Reverend Madeline talked about Cain and Abel, the Bible story. Here we go again, another Bible story. But Cain was so angry at God, he just didn't know what to do, where to go with it. And I felt like that. I was like, where do I go with this? You know, we didn't have a minister at the time, and writing a letter to the UU world didn't seem like that was going to be enough. So I thought about that article that Nancy wrote back in 2015, and I was furious. And I don't know if anybody else has ever done this, but you get on there and you start writing an email, and you're just the energy and everything, and you're just typing away, and then you hit that send button, and you go, oh, shit. Is there any way I can pull that back? You know? And it was just like, oh, man, what did I do? But Nancy got back to me. And instead of defending Black Lives Matters or defending what the congregation or, you know, what the denomination is doing under those terms, she listened. All she did was listen and understand. And there wasn't anything else she could do. And so I wrote her back shortly thereafter, and I apologized. And I said it was a bad day. But it was a culmination of many bad days, and things got better after that. But I wrote to her, and I said, I am so sorry that I wrote that to you, and, you know, that was just out of just this utter frustration and anger, and I needed to go somewhere with it. Look what happened to my son. Look what happened to my family. Look what happened to Ashley. Look what happened to Dave and his family. This isn't right. And I didn't mean to take it out on you. And she wrote back that any minister that can't take the rage and the anger off of one of their, you know, off of one of their, the people from their church or whatever, shouldn't be a minister. And I thought that was really nice, and I felt relief. And there was one more part of this that helped me connect again with being a UU, even though I felt at times that there was a disconnect. But I started to see that just because I believed one thing and this thing happened doesn't mean that this is wrong. And it doesn't mean that this takes everything away from this. It's still okay. It's still okay to believe this, even though this happened, even though this caused pain. And there was one more thing that happened. I have to give me just a second here. That really helped. And there was a ton of them. And I'm not going to say names, because I don't want to miss anybody. But we know you've been swamped with people and messages. Just want you to both know that we've been thinking about you and keeping informed via Brew and Anise. So relieved to know that Jesse will be okay, a Brew person. Dear Ann and Mark, now they also sent cards to Jesse. We were stunned by the announcement about Jesse at Brew this morning. I hope he makes a speedy and complete recovery. The Brew Choir. There's a lot of names on there that I won't go through all of these. Dear Ann and Mark, we're thinking about your family at this time and wishing you strength. Dear Ann and Mark, our thoughts and prayers, hugs and good wishes are focused on you, Jesse, and Dave, that all will be well soon. Know that we are only a phone call away, and trust, and if there's anything we can do to help. And that's just a fraction. That doesn't include the emails. That doesn't include the texts. We had a lot of people going through Karen Fitzgerald because it was just overwhelming. And so I don't know if we ever really properly thanked everybody. But thank you. One of the things I realized about my dilemma with being a UU is this is my home. This is my spiritual home. And while we don't always agree on whether on politics or the denomination doesn't always have what I think is appropriate for my family, this is still my home. And I'm not ready to leave it over this because this is just part of life. This is what life throws at you. And you have to, and for me, I keep saying you, but for me, I need to stand and get through the tough stuff. And I've been through some tough stuff in my own life and lives of our kids, but nothing as tough as that. Nothing that made me feel adrift. And I just want to thank you all for your cards, your well wishes, your thoughts, your prayers. And there's no way we can ever repay that. And I'm glad I'm back to being a UU. Thank you.